Christopher Woods first fell in love with public gardens growing up near London and working at the classic Kew Royal Botanical Gardens. Eventually, he'd serve as director and chief designer at a number of innovative botanical gardens in the United States and Canada. In his book, Garden Lust, a botanical tour of the world's best new gardens, he explores 50 of the most interesting gardens on 6 continents, from Dubai, Chile, Marrakesh in Australia, all the way to urban forest in Tokyo, and even a garden of glass in Seattle. Chris Woods, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm all into museums and castles and paintings and statues, and reading through your book, it just really struck me. Travelers should be tuned in to gardens, whether they're fancy themselves as a gardener or not.
I think many travelers are tuned into gardens. Botanical gardens, public gardens amass millions of visitors per year, and I think they're essential parts of world travel.
Now, in your book, you say that gardeners are artists rather than painting on canvas or chiseling in marble. How's a gardener an artist?
If you imagine that you were painting a picture and there was a frame and a canvas and you painted a very colorful painting, but once finished, the frame started to move and grow and the colors started to change and one of the key colors of the painting suddenly turned brown and disappeared. That's essentially what gardening is. It is a movable feast of color and texture.
So there's another dimension to it. It's sort of you can be intentional about the changes that'll happen through the seasons and have that all work out to your vision?
I think that most gardeners that I know, and I've said this about my own work, is that when it's successful, I'll take credit for it. and when it's not successful, I'll blame the weather.
It is an interesting idea that it's a dynamic work of art, if you want to. And you write how a gardener can pour his soul into one garden and shepherd it over many years. And you say that's the price of paradise. How does that work for a gardener to love a particular piece of land and what grows on it in an artistic way over the years?
You know, the title of my book is Garden Lust, which is a play on wanderlust. But if you take lust itself, and I don't mean that in a prurient way, but this deep desire, this attraction, whether you have an attraction to garden or paint or play music or write or whatever your expression, your passionate expression actually is, it applies to a garden. Most of the gardeners that I know, they tend to be obsessive, compulsive. They are asked to look at the smallest things that you can look at in nature and then step back and look at grand design. And so their minds are both kind of rammed into the earth itself, literally, and then pulled back at the same time. So what we talk about is our passion and our love of plants and nature and ecology and environment and so on and so on and so on. We're a voluble group of people, generally.
The personality of some of these crazy gardeners comes out in the way you cover the gardens. One of your featured gardens is in Sweden, and the gardener Peter Korn. You go back in his sort of history as a gardener, and you wrote that he had a teenage tryst with dahlias. And it was just infatuation. And then he moved on to more mature relationships. I never thought of gardening in that sense, but it really is a kind of a garden lust for a person like yourself who's self-described a biophiliac.
You know, I spent some time with Peter and I was interviewing him, and it was May in Sweden, which is still practically winter. It was freezing cold. We walked around every square centimeter of the garden and looked at every plant, including the little brown ones. And he was talking in the way that he would talk about great love, great romantic love of a human being. Now, so this book is about 50 gardens around the world. I've written about biodiversity, but it's also essential part of my life and an essential part of this book that this is about cultural diversity. I was not only visiting gardens, but I was visiting their creators and their relatives and the people involved. And I was also having dinner with them, and I was eating in foreign places and traveling to foreign places. So the book is much bigger than just writing about specifically 50 gardens.
Oh, yeah. And that's clear when you page through it. I expected to be reading, you know, like guidebook coverage of 50 great gardens. And it's more than that. As you said, there's many dimensions to it. And these people who who are characters, they're almost like eccentric in their love of gardens. Do you think there's a relationship between how technology has pretty much taken us away from nature? Does a garden become potentially more beautiful and more important in a world that is so technological and so far from, you know, basics of nature?
It's a very interesting question, and it requires an analysis of what technology has done for us. And so the answer is yes and no to your question, in that I think we value being away from technology and being able to touch and smell and look at versions of nature. And gardens are abridged versions of nature. It's not the wild. It's sanitized nature and constructed nature. But they do give us a respite. They are an oasis away from the madness of electronica. On the other hand, when I was researching my book, 3/4 of the research was done sitting in my office online. You know, so if technology can facilitate our access to a more textural, a real world, then all for the better.
You know, you're sort of philosophical in your approach to gardens, and I thought it was interesting how you remind us that it's kind of easy for a lot of people that go to gardens or try to, you know, enjoy nature to think of it as us and it. But to embrace nature properly, you've got to realize you're part of it.
I see no separation between me, my body, for example, and nature. You know, I was born and I have lived and I will die and I will complete a cycle in the same way that, you know, leaves sprout in the spring and drop off a tree in the fall. And it's normal. And my body is mostly made up of water and a few other chemicals. And, you know, it's my mind that gets in the way at times and creates a kind of false identity and a false separation.
So this back-to-the-womb approach to gardening can enhance the experience, I would imagine. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Christopher Woods, and he just loves interesting plants and gardens so much he's been described as a biophiliac. Christopher's been the director of the Chanticleer Garden near Philadelphia, the Botanical Gardens in Santa Barbara and in Vancouver, B.C., and the Mendocino Coast Botanical Garden. He explores innovations in public and private gardens in his colorful book, Garden Lust, a botanical tour of the world's best new gardens. A key word there, Chris, is new gardens. You know, because I read the book thinking, oh, we'll go to, you know, Bodenant Gardens in Wales or Powers Court in Ireland or Villandry at the Chateau in France. But those are all classic old world gardens. You made a point just to say gardens of the 21st century, didn't you?
Indeed. The criteria for my choice of gardens is that they should either be constructed, created in the last 17, 18 years or had serious and impactful alterations in the last 17, 18 years, thus making them contemporary.
You had some experience at the Kew Gardens, which to me is the classic old school garden. If you were the original director of the Kew Gardens outside of London and you walked into a modern botanical gardens, one of your favorites featured in your book, what would strike you as new and different in gardening?
Actually, I think Kew is modernizing its long history. It's almost 300 years history. Parts of it are a contemporary garden. But I think there are trends, and they're more than trends. They're strong movements. And one of the strongest is, let's say, environmental awareness or appropriate planting. And that includes using plants native to the region, plants that adapt to the climate of the region, even if they're not specifically native. I think there is a change in aesthetics, very much away from the formal Victorian style of gardening that's lasted far too long. And the changes towards a more naturalistic style of planting, although there are some very notable exceptions to that, and I'll point out one. In New Zealand, which is one of my favorite gardens in the book, which is called Parapuma, and it's in the South Island, and it is a formal garden with a central axis and side axes, but it's comprised exclusively of New Zealand native plants. So it's a native plant garden in a very formal European style. And I found that staggering, that combination of essentially 17th, 18th, 19th century design with this 21st century discovery of a country's native plants.
Because a Victorian or 19th century garden might actually think of itself more as an encyclopedia for people to go to, and they've got a big greenhouse, and here are the palms, and there's the carnivores, and there's the water lilies. That's my memory of Kew Gardens. But the gardens that you've featured are more indigenous, or more right in the land, and also in the land with modern culture. Describe this fascinating garden in an abandoned iron plant in Germany.
That was an extraordinary experience for me, in that this is an iron plant that is in the Ruhr Valley, that came up through the centuries, the industrial centuries, and then was very productive in terms of military expansion during the 20th century, both the First and the Second World Wars. It was eventually closed as a plant in 1968. Instead of pulling it down, the city decided to keep it and to not restore it as a working iron and steel plant, but to leave it in as a memory, but also as a place where people could enjoy all kinds of things. And one of the big furnaces is a concert center where they have all kinds of events and fireworks. I watched an elderly couple walk along what was a canal, which is now, it's still a canal, but it's got, you know, willows in it and kingfishers, and it smells good. And I, in a way, was transported back to what it was like in my imagination in 1944, when it was a sewer and there were slaves working for the Nazi armament world. That transformation of what was into what is, and taking something so horrible and making it so beautiful, is just extraordinary.
Christopher Woods set out on a global quest for the most interesting new gardens around the world. He presents 50 of his favorites from 6 continents in his illustrated book, Garden Lust. You'll find a link to his book with this week's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. Today's interview was recorded before the global pandemic. Christopher, when we think about these gardens, you wrote, when in the context of the Crossrail Station roof garden in London, that it was a joy to see a garden that's not dumbed down, one that expects intelligence from its visitor. What do you mean by that?
Where this garden is, and it's on top of a subway system that is going from east to west through London, but originally it was in the Docklands. So these were the Docklands. It's now a huge corporate area of London. But it was the Docklands, and that's where plants were brought in for the first time. Bananas were first brought in. All kinds of spices from China and so forth. It was the center of transportation in the 17th and 18th centuries. And the garden expresses that. It explains it to some degree. And it connects the people who visit the garden. And as I say, it's surrounded by large corporate centers, so there are lots of people having lunch and sitting down. But it connects people with essentially the roots of agricultural and industrial history. But this encapsulates so much of British commercial history during the heyday, the great days of the British Empire. And it encapsulates it in such a good way and in such a pleasingly aesthetic way that I thought it was tremendous.
You mentioned the Chihuly Garden in Seattle, where glass is mixed in with all of the beautiful flowers. It's fun to think that a lot of these gardens that were your favorites mix in innovative new parts of the environment, or glass, or industry, or, you know, you're surrounded by skyscrapers, and it's a cohesive kind of whole. Describe your experience at the Chihuly Garden in Seattle.
Well, you know, Dale Chihuly is one of the foremost artists of this 20th and 21st century, and his work with glass is innovative and revolutionary for its time. But what I really liked about it was that the garden corresponds to the colors of the glass and the textures and the forms of the glass, the sculpture of the glass. And Richard Hartledge, who is the landscape architect who designed that garden, was very responsive to Chihuly's work. So, for example, there's a great picture in my book of some very deep blue kind of spears of glass designed by Chihuly, and correspondingly, in terms of plants, there's a deep blue bulb called a chamassia that grows amongst it. And the combination and the correlation, the dance between the two blues of the glass and the plant is extraordinarily clever. And it impressed me immensely that this association between what is static, which is the sculpture, and what is moving, that is the plants, was so cleverly done, well done.
Listening to you, Chris, talk about garden lust, appreciating gardens, it's a lot like art lust. When you go to a great art gallery, the more you can bring to that experience, I mean, it can be enjoyable anyway, but the more you can bring, I think the more you can appreciate that there's a lot of thought that goes into this artistic genius behind the work you're enjoying.
It is art lust, and it's life lust. And in the preface to my book, I talk about my book as a love letter to the planet, and that is my form of love letter to the planet, is to write this book. Because as much as we have seen all kinds of horrible things, certainly in my lifetime, there are so extraordinarily beautiful things out there, whether it's a painting in a museum in Venice or a garden in Seattle. These are life-affirming and beautiful things. And so I'm in love with this planet, despite its difficulties. I'm in love with life, despite my difficulties. And so my book is a heartfelt love letter.
It's a beautiful thing. In fact, that's one note I took after reading your book. You wrote, "It's a love letter to the planet and a celebration of the people who dared to create such beauty." I'd say it's also a celebration of those of us who take the interest and take the initiative to appreciate it and enjoy it.
I hope so.
Christopher Woods, thanks so much for being with us. Congratulations on a beautiful book, Garden Lust.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch, row by row, someone bless these seeds I sow. Someone warm them from below till the rain comes tumbling.
Put an impression or two from your travels into the form of a haiku poem, and we might just read it on the air. Here are some travel haiku our listeners have written that we thought you might enjoy.
Rebecca Saffron from San Diego, California, sends us this image of the capital of Latvia in her haiku. Riga collapses. Green nets hold it together, keeps buildings intact. Nick Popolo from Staten Island, New York, writes this haiku about a trip to Greece. Greece was calling me, where history was first taught, civilization. Chris White lives in Marlborough-on-Hudson in New York State and is particularly proud of the Italian part of his family heritage. I'm half Italian. My blood is from Vicenza. You're in big trouble.
The views are absolutely amazing in the mountains of Switzerland. We'll take a look next on Travel with Rick Steves. We're at 877-333-RICK.